Thanks for joining me. I'm Kara Lawrence, and this is Let's Hear It. Tomorrow night at 7:30 at Kalamazoo College in the Dalton Theater, the Kalamazoo Philharmonia will open its season with a vast and interesting program. And here to talk about it is the conductor of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, Andrew Kohler, a very busy man. You've got Mozart on the brain, Mahler on the brain, and of course, for tomorrow night, there's so much more. And I'm so excited to talk about this with you, Andrew.
Oh, thanks, Kara. Thanks for having me. Yes, it is. Been quite a week, yeah.
Before we get anywhere, full disclosure, I am a participant in tomorrow night's concert and have been trying to do my due diligence where that is concerned. But I really am, I'm really thinking about this interview and just wanting to kind of enthuse over the music and what's in it. I mean, I didn't think I'd like this giant symphony quite so much, but it is wonderful. And we'll get to the Nielsen, I think. But this concert begins with work by Adolphus Hale Storck, who is a difficult composer to pin down, actually.
Yes, his voice is rather wide-ranging, isn't it? Yeah. It's quite interesting because, I was introduced to his music through a piece called Ports of Call, which is a quite lively and even a little bit sarcastic, quite humorous work. And so I had this sort of notion. I mean, certainly the one thing that sort of defines him, especially given that he's a living composer, this is a contemporary composer. He just recently celebrated an 80th birthday, retired not too long ago from Old Dominion University, where he'd been working for a long time. But, what defines his style throughout is an allegiance to still a very tonal language. That is to say, he never seems to have been seduced by serialism or any of those other 20th century trends, which sort of value dissonance above consonance. He certainly has plenty of dissonance, like all composers do in his music, but fundamentally relies on a kind of tonality that is rooted in consonants. But yes, his works can range from extremely serious to sort of celebratory to lamenting to really quite funny. And it's really all over the map. So it's really exciting to hear a voice that that has such range. And in our particular circumstance, we're going to play a very short but exceptionally effective, I would say, opener called The Fanfare on Amazing Grace, which is pretty much exactly what it sounds like. This is not the most intuitive marriage of ideas. He takes the old hymn Amazing Grace that I think just about everybody knows, and he doesn't exactly present it in full, but he presents many passages from that theme in a way that make them quite recognizable. Although he does a nice thing where he sort of hides it just for a second at the beginning, so you're not quite sure, and then all of a sudden it explodes outward, and then you're like, oh, that's, there it is, now I get it, now I hear it. And over top of this, he kind of pays homage to Baroque fanfare style with these ornate scalar lines in the brass being traded back and forth in an imitative way. Also punctuated very beautifully by timpani, which he even goes so far as to ask for the timpani to play with wooden sticks, which gives a much drier sound, one that would have been typical for the Baroque era even. So he puts these two things together, and like I say, I'm no composer, but one thinks of Amazing Grace and Baroque fanfares, they don't seem like they naturally melt together, but Hale Storck proves very much that they can go together wonderfully.
Effortlessly, really. And just to remind listeners again, this is a 7:30 concert Saturday night at Kalamazoo College. It's a ticketed event. You'll find the details at the K College website for the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. Mm-hmm. Also on Facebook as well, there's an event page there so you can learn the details. The orchestra has been playing masked for months, and certain sections have been tested and we'll be able to play maskless, but mostly masked, and I'm sure school policy requires masks.
That's correct for all our audience members, yes.
Okay. Well, here is a taste of tomorrow's music, The Fanfare on Amazing Grace by Adolphus Hale Storck. ¶¶ the fanfare on Amazing Grace by Adolphus Hale Stork, and I'm speaking about this season opening program with Andrew Kohler, leading the Kalamazoo Philharmonia tomorrow at 7:30 in the Dalton Theater at the Light Fine Arts Building at Kalamazoo College. This was an easy, quote, easy read through. We just went right through it, and most of it was already there.
I find probably
the most challenging parts are percussion and drums, or percussion and brass.
Brass, that's absolutely the case. Those fanfares are quite difficult, but, you know, those our colleagues in those sections took a nice look at them beforehand. I obviously were ready to go. And everything else kind of is, it's just, you know, you can hear those snatches of the hymn that we all know, and it fits together so beautifully. I think that's the thing. I mean, as I say, at first glance, you think, no, this... what a strange marriage of things. But then when you actually hear it and when you play it, you feel like it was meant to be all along. And it's really lovely when something like that happens. And I mean, music can be very rewarding when it challenges the player and the listener, and you sort of have to grapple with it until you get it. But sometimes it's awfully nice just to sink into a piece that just feels like, yep, this all makes sense. And I think this is one of those pieces for me, at least.
I'm glad you noted that some of his music feels like he's a humorist. He enjoys humor, and that's, I think that he shares that a bit with Carl Nielsen as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yes, Carl Nielsen is also, yes, definitely has that rather cheeky sense of humor.
Good nature.
I will say, on the other hand, as is true for Nielsen as well, that Hale Stork is a composer who also certainly delves into serious themes. In fact, I heard an interview with him where he talked about how, since he grew up in an Anglican church tradition, that, you know, he was singing all the time, and he often thinks of music as having a meaning, and indeed sometimes even a sort of social implication. He's been writing a lot of music recently that deals with some issues of racial injustice in the nation, you know, responding to George Floyd. That's what some of his newest works have been. So whether they necessarily have a text, many of them do. He sometimes writes for chorus or soloists. You know, he is a composer of color. This is, of course, these are, you know, themes that resonate particularly with him and in his personal life. And I think it's, you know, one of the things that even this work in its short runtime, its modest way, right, to mix like this celebratory fanfare with the notion of Amazing Grace, right, saving a wretch like me, right, already has, in a very subtle kind of way, a slightly spiritual component, something that's hinting at what all the pieces today on our program hint at, which is this notion of transcendence. That's what the title of the program is. I think in some ways we can understand that word in a number of different ways. One way is the notion of persevering against hardship, right? So as a composer of color, we're also on the first half listening to Beethoven, who famously endured this disability of deafness and was able to continue to compose. You know, really grappled with it, almost brought him to suicide at one point, and he decided against it. And then a 20th century suffragette, Dame Ethel Smyth, all of whom had many obstacles placed in their way before they were able to get their voices heard. And of course, the other idea of transcendence is this sort of more difficult to define spiritual realm that I'm talking about, this idea that somehow art is the vehicle by which we can take our daily lives, the quotidian aspects of our lives, but somehow connect to something greater, universal, and more profound. That's something that Carl Nielsen, I know, felt very strongly as well, and why he, it's been argued, titled his symphony the Espansiva, which means the expansive symphony, because it's not longer or larger orchestrationally than most of his other symphonies, but I think the idea was it's about how art can expand the scope of the mind, as a noted biographer of his, Robert Simpson, put it. So that's this subtle sort of religious transcendent theme that kind of unites all of the works on the program.
That leads us right to the Heiliger Dankgesang, the song, Holy Song of Thanks.
That's right.
Which appears as a movement in a late Beethoven quartet. And is this timed as this is an expression, direct expression of his own personal struggle.
It is.
He admitted that, like, in the score.
Yes, it's right in there. So the full title, you know, I've been calling it simply the Heiliger Dankgesang, as you have, but it's actually Heiliger Dankgesang eines Genesenen an die Gottheit in der Lüdischen Tonart, which is quite a mouthful, as you can imagine, but it means Holy Song of Thanks from a Convalescent to God in the Lydian Mode. So the Lydian Mode, this is one of those old church modes that had fallen out of fashion by Beethoven's day, we're hundreds of years at this point already. So it might seem like a quizzical detail to include in the title, but I think he's trying to suggest that he's tying in to an older spiritual tradition. You know, again, this transcending boundaries of time, which Beethoven was all about at the near the end. And in this particular case, this convalescence was not from his deafness, of course, that he never recovered from that. That he was a much younger man when he sort of had this struggle with his deafness and contemplated suicide and said, no, only art saved me from the brink. You know, it brought me back and I must continue to compose. Instead, as a more mature composer, he was already well established and sort of kind of on the other end of that spectrum of that feeling that I was just describing. Instead, he had a stomach ailment and he wasn't sure. It was bad enough that he was really worried that this might be the end for him, as, you know, in those days, who knows? I mean, any number of what we might take for granted as something that should be solvable would be potentially fatal.
Or undiagnosable.
Yeah, right, exactly. But he eventually did recover and he was filled with such a profound sense of gratitude for just even a little bit more time. What happened was this slow central movement that's, about 16 minutes, quite long for a single string quartet movement, of his Opus 132, one of the great late quartets, which is already one of the most extraordinary groupings of works in music. It's just among the most moving passage of music that I know. It's a very simple design. You hear basically a chorale-like tune, and it comes back two other times. And in between, there's a secondary idea, which is also comes back a second time. And so it's a double series of variations, so to speak. And the secondary idea is marked Neue Kraft fühlen, which means feeling new strength. So
this part.
Yes, he feels himself finally back on his feet. And the first part is just exactly what it sounds like. It is a profound prayer of thanks. It is Beethoven being able to connect this very, in a sense, simple daily act, right? The fact that he feels better and that his body functions and allows him to write music, to do something that connects to this much wider humanity. Mm-hmm. And I think also in our, you know, one other reason why I was so moved to choose this work at this moment, this is, of course, a transcription for string orchestra that I did from the original string quartet.
You did it?
Yes.
Wow.
It's just...
That's a lot of work. And I love how you, at some point, you brought it down to string quartet.
Mm-hmm,
in
yes.
the transcription. Well, so, it's wonderful.
Well, that moment, thank you for mentioning that. That moment is marked mit innigste Empfindung, with the innermost feeling at that moment. So, and I thought this was the perfect moment to maybe just pare it down to the original string quartet again so that we have that feeling of interiority. It is really just a supremely, supremely beautiful music, really, really moving. And as I was trying to say earlier, it is something that I think for our moment right now, having dealt with so much illness, as we seek to find gratitude for our health, for those of us who are lucky enough to have it, and move forward, it just has a special resonance for this moment.
If you're in the theater, you'll know. You'll just know. It's extremely manipulative in that sense. You cannot help but whatever you were feeling at the moment, it goes away when this movement starts. Let's hear a little bit of it, because we still have a wonderful Unknown Overture and the Nielsen Symphony to get to. I'm with Andrew Kohler, the conductor of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. Find details on tomorrow night's concert at philharmonia.kzoo.edu. have to leave the Beethoven for now as we explore the repertory for tomorrow night's concert by the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. I'm with Andrew Kohler, and it's his own transcription of this quartet movement for string orchestra that we'll hear tomorrow in a program called Transcendence. And hopefully you heard an explanation of that before the music, because all the pieces are tied by this idea of being part of something bigger and, you know, how it lifts us out of our own loneliness.
Exactly.
So we can continue now with music by Dame Ethel Smythe. I wish I could grab that little clip. I was wondering, you know, you were asking, how do we pronounce Smythe? Is it's Smith or Smythe? And I'm like, oh, Smith. No. I found an old documentary with Dame Ethel Smythe.
Yes, quite.
Her life is more than her fight for women's rights.
Yes.
But it's a big part, and it is kind of the thing a lot of her reputation hangs on today.
That's right.
But I think of her as a young woman growing up, as a privileged young woman.
That's right.
In a stratified society where she knew she was expected to kind of conform to the, you know, bringing the family name forward by marrying and having children.
Mm-hmm.
And she bucked that very early.
Yes, absolutely. All of it. I mean, she really, you know, I mean, there's some private letters where she talks about quite openly talks about the fact that she's attracted to women. And she had many relationships with many prominent women. She actually fell in love, apparently, with Virginia Woolf at, you know, she was already like 70 or something at this point, you know?
Mm.
So she had very passionate, intense affairs with women, you know, rarely with men, although on occasion, and certainly recognized how probably, you know, I'll use the word unusual, but how not accepted that was in that particular stratified society that you mentioned. On top of it, yes, there was that struggle for suffrage for women to gain the vote, which just to clarify a little further, was not some, you know, as a woman of relative privilege, you're right, because she was born into a wealthy family, might have been just sort of on the sidelines, cheerleading, financing kind of thing. But it was much more than that. I mean, she wrote what became sort of the anthem of the women's suffragette movement as a composer. She was even jailed briefly for, well, I mean, several months, actually. I guess that's not too brief, for actions that she had taken. So she was really quite...
She was involved in some violent episodes.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, she was really, you know, really committed to the cause. This really meant a lot to her. And you know, an anecdote about this particular piece, this Wreckers piece that I recount in the program notes, and that I think really kind of gives you a sense of her personality, is that, you know, like Covent Garden, which is the premier opera house in England, in London, at that time apparently wouldn't really premiere any native composers' music until it had found success abroad. Somehow that was the yardstick by which things were measured. They had to find success on the continent, in Europe, before it would be premiered there. So she sort of took that route, and because she had studied in Germany and she had rubbed elbows with Clara Schumann and Brahms and all the, you know, the finest composers of that region, she had some contacts in Leipzig and actually got a performance of this piece in Leipzig. She was very excited about it, but they had made some decisions to cut a considerable portion of the second act of the Wreckers.
Yeah.
And she sort of came in and said, well, I don't like this at all. And they said, oh, it'll be fine. People like it. And indeed, people loved it. She actually had a wonderful reception. So think about this. I mean, a woman composer who's already having a fight just to get any of her music heard, right, who's being constantly criticized. All the press is always saying, if she writes something beautiful and you know, thoughtful and intimate, that, oh,
it's girly.
Exactly. It's not a very masculine piece. She doesn't really keep up with the men. But, you know, and then she writes something very muscular and vital, and it's sort of, you know, sort of shocking that the woman would write something so unwomanly. Yes, exactly. Right. I mean, she really can't win, right, as she's writing this stuff. But here she is having a great success, right? A fine house, opera house is premiering this work. The audience is really enjoying it, is really responding to it. But it's been cut from what she knows it's supposed to be. And she knows that there are aspects of it that are missing that she cares about. And the conductor apparently was unsympathetic, didn't want to change what he had already. So she goes into the pit right after that first performance, picks up all the parts, all the score, and then drives out of town with them on a train to Prague or something like that. So they can't perform it anymore. Oh, so that was it. That was it. This is a true story. Apparently she just felt like, no, you will not perform my work in a mutilated way. I will not have it. And that's that.
Well, how do we get this wonderful overture? Is it what she wrote for the opera in the first place?
It is what she wrote for the opera in the first place, with a concert ending added by her, and the concert ending comes from other parts of the opera. So it's a wonderful... I should probably explain a little bit about what this curious title, The Wreckers, means. The Wreckers is about... This all came from a trip she took to Cornwall. And there's a history of these poor sort of fishing villages, largely, who really struggled even to make ends meet with the fishing, taking advantage of a maritime law at the time that basically said, if there's a shipwreck on your shores and there are no survivors, then you are welcome to plunder whatever is on that ship. Yeah. Now, they sort of read that law rather tendentiously and figured, well, if we ensure that there are no survivors, i.e., that is, we kill anybody who's on board, then there are no survivors, and therefore that's ours. And then if we possibly put out lights that confuse the ships at night so that they actually wash ashore, they ground themselves ashore, guarantee that there'll be a shipwreck, well, that's okay, too. That's just... But what fascinated Smythe is the mixture of this ease with which they commit violence and the extraordinary piousness and religiosity of these communities who say, basically pray to God for him to bring to them a ship that they might plunder, right? Without sort of seeing the tension between what it is that they're doing and, you know, whether or not, and indeed the very first words, there's a chorale that happens in the middle of this overture, or about three quarters of the way through the overture. And in that chorale, that's actually when the curtain goes up in the original opera and the chorus starts singing. And what they're singing is, we are God's chosen people and we are washed white of any sin. God protects us from committing sin because we are his chosen people.
That is fascinating. A devout group of looters and murderers.
Essentially. It's a contradiction that obviously fascinated Smythe. And then against this backdrop, of course, there's A Tale of Forbidden Love. And you can see how for Smythe, this notion of not only forbidden love, but a kind of piousness that commits violence, or cruelty, right, in the name of religion, all those things would have certainly resonated with her own personal experience, or at least one can imagine how they would have resonated with her. But this overture is it's just a great introduction to Smythe and really the very sure hand she had with the orchestra and with thematic development and all the things we love to hear in great composers.
It's great. It's unladylike. It's adventurous.
Yes. So the very first theme is very much a, you know, redolent of the high seas kind of thing. And then there's a very nice sort of, in my opinion, kind of recreation of these cliffs of Cornwall, which, you know, basically you hear this jagged, you know, leaping theme. And then you hear the theme, the earlier theme of the seas kind of break apart into its component pieces, almost as if you're hearing a shipwreck in real time. And then there's a beautiful theme in the middle, very warm and rich. And then eventually we get to this chorale that I was just mentioning. And then she sort of ties it all back together at the end.
We are down to 12 minutes left in the hour, so we'll see how much we can get to here, but we have to move on to the Nielsen next.
Absolutely.
I'm with Andrew Kohler, and this is Let's Hear It on Classical WMUK. Well, that is a taste of Dame Ethel Smythe's Overture to the Wreckers. And we are, well, both of us, Andrew Kohler and myself, looking forward to the concert tomorrow night. I am a participant as a part of the flute section. Mm-hmm. And the concert will close with music of Carl Nielsen. Danish composer, wrote symphonies total. Is he considered one of the group of symphonists, though, that you would, you know, you would count with your Beethoven, your Brahms, your Sibelius? I mean,
I think that he's the dark horse candidate to be counted in that. But more, and I'm hearing more and more people say they believe that. I mean, he certainly, I believe absolutely that he is. Not everyone might agree. He's a little bit of a quirky taste, I think, but I am totally won over by, and I think that this symphony, this Espansivo symphony, which again is, you know, expansive, not in any sense of length, but rather in terms of just the concept of how art can expand our lives and connect it to that of a greater humanity. You know, this really was the symphony that marked his mature voice, I think. You know, the first two symphonies are excellent, wonderful works, but in the same way that Beethoven's first two symphonies were the work of a composer who had learned his craft thoroughly, and the third sort of marked this new path for him, the third also for Nielsen marks a new path. And interestingly, and not coincidentally, I think, he begins with what is a pretty subtle allusion to Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. Beethoven's Eroica Symphony famously starts with these two brusque chords, and then there's this triadic melody. And Nielsen kind of takes that idea and says, you know, hold my beer, as the kids say these days, right? the idea is that he takes this repeated note, and you have it once, you have it twice, you think, okay, very good. And then he goes on and does it 24 more times, basically contracting the amount of time between the chord until that first triadic melody, when we hear it, feels not so much just introduced as like shot out of a cannon. This entire first movement is the most remarkable masterclass in and simply rhythmic electricity of material. I mean, it feels like it goes by in an instant almost. All this music, right? Because there's just such vitality constantly burbling under the surface.
You're conducting in one. I mean, that to me is very divergent from an opening movement of a symphony.
Yeah.
One, two, three. One, two, three. One. I mean, it's not a waltz, but it has that wonderful, I want to sort of rock back and forth while holding my beer sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That's what puts a smile on my face. That's where I think this man is so good-natured. And yeah. You feel also, you know, not left out in the wilderness. You kind of trust where he's going.
Yes.
With this material.
And he takes you all kinds of places. And that's the other amazing, I mean, there's been much ink spilled about what exactly the form of this movement. It is not a traditional way of going through a first movement of a symphony. A lot of things do look familiar, but he just takes these ideas and he keeps recombining them in unexpected ways. And you think, huh, I didn't think that A could lead to C like that, you know? I thought A could only go to B and B to C, no? But then A goes to C and then C goes to B, and then it goes all kind of different directions, and yet they all work, and he constantly keeps you engaged.
I will say that he does something completely impractical in the second movement. It shouldn't be there, but it is.
Yes, yes. It is a wonderful surprise, and I was just saying to Kara that I first discovered it as a surprise, so we're going to keep it a surprise for your listeners. They'll have to come and hear what the orchestrational surprise is near the end of the second movement, but it is really a magical touch.
It's the sort of thing programmers just tear their hair out over. Why would you ask for this?
But it's so worth it that he did.
It's so wonderful. Again, the concert is tomorrow at 7:30 in the Dalton Theater at Kalamazoo College. It is a ticketed event. You'll find details at philharmonia.kazoo.edu. That's KZOO. And we have just talked about wonderful fanfare on Amazing Grace by Adolphus Hale Stork, a movement from a late Beethoven symphony expanded to strings, the Heiliger Dankesang movement, and Ethel Smythe's Overture to the Wreckers. Let's finish with the first movement of Carl Nielsen's Symphony No. 3. Any final words?
simply that I really feel like this idea of transcendence, of connecting to a larger humanity, of feeling our strength again after illness is I hope, something that all of us need to feel communally together. And it'll be exciting to have an audience back in Dalton Theater tomorrow night.
By the way, Andrew, I think this recording is a bit slower than we're taking it. So be ready for a slightly laid back version.
It's all good.